This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Mike Murphy and myself will host members with the Sunrise Project out of Lawrence, Kansas, whose mission is to provide a center for education and community outreach with programming focused on the intersection of food, the environment, and social justice. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I'm glad to be back this week with your environmental news. EcoWatch.com reports, 19 Yale students were arrested by Yale police following a day-long sit-in that called for the university to reopen the conversation on fossil fuel divestment. Yale is one of the first schools where a fossil fuel divestment action has led to arrest. Students held the sit-in to call on Yale to reopen the conversation on fossil fuel divestment. The sit-in follows a two-year effort by the student group Fossil Free Yale to work with the administration to divest the university's endowment from fossil fuels. In August 2014, Yale refused to divest, announcing instead a series of sustainability initiatives. Fossil Free Yale continued to attempt to work with the administration to achieve divestment, arguing that sustainability is unable to address the social injustices of fossil fuel extraction and burning. The university has not responded to these claims, and Fossil Free Yale held the sit-in to hold Yale decision makers responsible. Quote, Yale would rather arrest its students than re-engage in the conversation, end quote, said Fossil Free Yale project manager Mitch Barrows. During the arrest, 160 students gathered on the plaza, and students told the story of Fossil Free Yale and Blue Feather Drum Group, a Native American performance group, performed and discussed the links between the fossil fuel industry and marginalized communities. ENN.com reports, USDA researchers have identified the neonicotinoid insecticide clothianidin as a likely contributor to monarch butterfly declines in North America. The USDA research is published in the Journal of Science of Nature and was published online on the 3rd of April of this year. Monarch butterfly populations have declined precipitously in North America in the last 20 years. This decline has commonly been linked to loss of milkweeds from farmers' fields. Monarch caterpillars are dependent on milkweeds. The ability of farmers to kill them with the Monsanto herbicide Roundup containing glyphosate has therefore led to this herbicide being considered as a major contributor to the decline of the monarch butterfly. However, industrial farming methods include other known or potential causes of monarch disappearances. One of these is the known toxicity of BT insecticides found in GMO crops. Neonicotinoids have been strongly implicated as pollinator declines worldwide, as shown by a report from a task force of the International Union of Nature Conservation based in Switzerland. These pesticides, such as clothianidin, made by Bayer, are a particular hazard because, unlike most pesticides, they are water-soluble molecules. From soil or seed treatments, they can reach nectar and are found in pollen. They are now the most widely used pesticide in the world. Up to now, there has been negligible research on the effects of neonicotinoids on butterflies, and this new research is therefore the first to link them to the survival and reproduction of any butterfly. TheGuardian.com reports, research published last Friday, the 10th, indicates 23 gigawatts, 7% of U.S. coal capacity, will come offline due to a combination of low gas prices, new mercury emission standards, and the age of closing power plants. Quote, on an emission rate basis, 2015 will be the cleanest year in over 60 years for which we have historical data, end quote, says the report. At the same time, investment in renewables is rising fast with a new 18 gigawatts of clean energy due to starting feeding into the grid this year. BNEF says new solar installations will hit an all-time high of 9.1 gigawatts led by California, while new wind build will hit 8.8 gigawatts with a third of new projects in Texas. Cutting its use of oil is one of the main strategies in the Obama administration's domestic and international efforts to address climate change. The U.S. has a 2020 goal of curbing greenhouse gas emissions 17% on 2005 levels and a 2030 target recently submitted to the UN of 28% cuts on the 2005 levels. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, in 2014, 38% of U.S. energy-related CO2 emissions came from the power generation sector. Of that, 76% of emissions were from coal, with 22% from gas. The U.S. coal power sector is set to face further restrictions once the Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan is finalized later this year. The EPA says it will help cut CO2 emissions from the power sector 30% on 2005 levels. The law is set to rule out the use of all but the most efficient coal plants. And at this time, I'd like to welcome Mike Murphy to the mic.
Hey, thank you very much, Natural E. Looks like we've got a very interesting program tonight. A couple of folks from the Sunrise Project are on the phone with us. We've got Melissa Freiberger and Rachel Vaughn from the Sunrise Project. And good evening, folks.
Good evening. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us today. So you guys are both sharing a phone. Is that so you can both hear the questions and everything? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Sunrise Project, tell us what you guys do.
The Sunrise Project seeks to be a center for education, for community outreach, and our focus really will be on programming that engages the interconnections between food, environment, and social justice. We imagine ourselves to be working towards resilient communities and equitable food and environmental systems. We are a local grassroots organization in Lawrence, Kansas, and currently we have a contingent contract on the historic Sunrise Garden Center Nursery, which is located in an urban environment in East Lawrence, located at 15th and Lennard Street. And this is something that we see as a really ideal location because it is in a blended income neighborhood, and it's located on 3 acres. There's a lot of possibilities for growth space. We as a project, see ourselves really as an umbrella organization, an incubator, if you will, for a variety of other local as well as regional projects that may be looking for space or workshops, outlets for programming development or support. And currently we have a few projects already that are taking part in our umbrella organizing, and that includes the Lawrence Fruit Tree Project, which is an urban community orchard, as well as a farm-to-preschool program called Healthy Sprouts. And we also have an after-school program that is fairly new, but seems to have generated an incredible amount of feedback already, and that is called Food Rocket. So it's a pilot project that's an after-school program at Cordley Elementary School.
And so do you own this this Sunrise Garden Center? Are you working on owning it, or?
We have put a contract. This is Melissa. We've put a contract on the property. We have 120 days, which have already started. So we're working to a mid-June deadline to raise the money. So the contingencies that we have on the with the contract are raising the funds, the property will need to be rezoned, and the third contingency is an environmental assessment, which is underway right now.
So I'm all in favor of environmental assessments being done, but I find it odd that would need to be done for, like, what usually that involves some kind of building or some kind of, you know, what are you guys doing that's required, or does that happen anytime that there's a transfer of land?
Well, this greenhouse is almost 100 years old. So chemicals and fertilizers, things have been used since been banned. And so because we want to grow healthy food here at that site, we are having the environmental assessment done.
Okay, and so what's involved in an environmental assessment? Is that, does the EPA get involved in that, or KDHE, or?
KDHE is involved. They are involved. The first phase is a series of questions that are asked to previous owners, and then from there, the phase one, they determine if phase two is needed, and that's where they actually will go and dig up pieces of the land to test. And that's the phase that we're in right now, is we're doing the phase two to see how healthy the soil is and to ensure that there haven't been chemicals that would not be healthy for gardening and growing food at the site.
Okay. And so it seems like you guys have like two kind of foci here. One is this piece of property and what, you know, what can come out of the immediately surrounding community, that very neighborhood, like what magic can be worked in that neighborhood. But your scope is not limited to that neighborhood, that you're looking at, you know, all of Douglas County or perhaps larger. So when you widen that scope, what do you envision is replicating what will be happening at Sunrise Gardens, or does that make sense?
Yes. This is Rachel. We are really imagining that both local level organizations, but also potentially other organizations in surrounding communities could find a potential home here, potential space, perhaps they need outlet for grow room, or perhaps it's a workshop site. So there are a number of possibilities for people both within the neighborhood, within the broader community, within Douglas County, but then really also making connections beyond Douglas County too. And I do think that eventually we can create a replicable model that other communities could look towards and be inspired by.
So it seems like there's some things that you can do in tandem, and there's some things you have to do in kind of sequence. And so your first order of business is securing this land, which involves securing funds. Is that right?
Yeah.
And
we're also all volunteer run right now. So operating costs, finding a site, those are really important matters that we're working on right now.
And what kind of support are you getting in the community, both in, you know, the immediate neighborhood there in East Lawrence and, you know, in the city of Lawrence?
People are super supportive and excited. We have just begun the fundraising, so that's definitely evolving, but we have tons of support, and people are very excited to see this historic greenhouse turned into this community resource that we're describing. And also a lot of positive feedback on the programming that's already underway as part of as we're serving as the umbrella organization for. So, I mean, excellent feedback on the after-school programming, Food Rocket, strong feedback and participation in the community orchard already, and Healthy Sprouts has already established a tradition here in Lawrence.
And so what kind of support are you getting out from the actual municipality of Lawrence?
I think that because we're still in the very beginning stages, that all the support and collaboration that it's going to take to make this happen is underway. And so far, our interaction with the city is mostly working out the zoning question at this time. But as far as the community members, we've really got the support that we need, yes.
How is it zoned now, and what kind of zoning are you looking to have it change to?
Well, it was grandfathered in as the nursery, and it was commercial. And because it's been vacant, it has gone back to residential zoning. And because we do have a business partner to help us make this happen that we are working with when we put the contract on the property. We're working with Central Soy Food, which is a local organic tofu and tempeh producer. And because they want to do that on the site as well, we're going to have to rezone it to light industrial. So those are, that's, again, another contingency that we have on the contract is getting that rezoned.
So Central Soy wants a piece of, what are they looking to do on this site? Are they looking to grow soy?
They're looking for a new home. They're looking to relocate their facility, and they see this as an ideal location for them. Create a super green space, and we could use the steam that's used to produce the tofu to heat one of our greenhouses. So we see a very symbiotic relationship with this local business. They, again, organic, they use local soybeans, their product, and we see this as a very positive partnership for what we want to create at Sunrise.
So I'm still not clear. Are they looking to grow soy there, or is that where they're going? I don't know where they grow their soy. Or maybe they don't grow their soy. Maybe they buy it from organic farmers. I don't know how
they do. They buy it from local organic growers, and then they turn it into tofu and tempeh.
So this is basically their processing facility, right, is what we're talking about.
That's right.
Okay. And so... Is that a tricky dance to do, being both, this merger of nonprofit and for-profit enterprises?
I think it's a way to create sustainability. As one of the former directors of the Healthy Sprouts program, we know that nonprofits are always hustling for money and grants, and developing a business partnership, I think, will just help with that sustainability piece. And already, we see very positive outcomes with this relationship.
Okay. I'm looking at your website now, sunriseprojectks.org, if folks at home want to take a look as well. And What are you guys doing to generate funds?
Well, we've got a couple of forthcoming fundraisers that we definitely want to make sure people are aware of. But we do want to emphasize that no donation is too small, and folks can definitely visit our website, sunriseprojectks.org, to make donations to us. The upcoming fundraiser that we particularly want to highlight is this Sunday, April 19th, at Liberty Hall here in Lawrence, 644 Massachusetts Street. And from 4 to 7 p.m., we are going to be doing a screening of Dan Sussman's 2013 documentary titled Growing Cities, which is a documentary on urban farming across the United States. So for only $40, we have a pretty wonderful evening event planned, and that'll include the documentary screening in a really iconic Lawrence venue, Liberty Hall, and then we have a dinner arranged, which is catered by 23rd Street Brewery, who have been very generous to us in arranging this event. And then we have a really strong panel of invited speakers who have agreed to help propel dialogue about the film over dinner. And that panel of speakers includes Kansas City's own Catherine Kelly, executive director and founder of Cultivate Kansas City. It includes Dinah Newman, the health initiative manager for Grown in Ivanhoe, a project which is the Grown in a particular neighborhood certification project. Richard Mabian.
Oh, I heard of him.
Organizer. Clean Air Ambassador for Earth Justice, the legal advocacy organization. Sierra Club board member, president of the NAACP. We also have Brett Ramey, someone here from the local community who is now at the University of Washington and is the community engagement coordinator for Native People for Cancer Control. And the panel will be moderated by University of Kansas Assistant Professor of Spanish and Portuguese, Magali Rabassa. So it's set up to be a wonderful evening, and that is our first major fundraiser.
Well, that sounds great, and we're proud of Richard Mabian for being a part of that, our very own Richard Mabian, who actually wanted to be here in on this interview tonight but couldn't be due to a death in the family, and so we miss Richard and sending out our positive thoughts to him. And what made you approach Richard? Why did you know him, or?
Well, we have another board member who did all the footwork for getting the panel together, but we wanted it to be, we wanted people there representing more than just the food aspect, bringing in the environment, and there's so much good stuff happening in Kansas City that we can learn from. So we're so excited to have Richard join us on Sunday.
So again, that's this Sunday at Liberty Hall, and it's at what time?
4 to 7 p.m. On April 19th.
And what can you tell us about this film you're showing? Because I haven't seen it.
The film it engages a number of different interviews that Dan Sussman conducts across the United States. And it starts in Omaha, Nebraska, in his hometown. And he starts the conversation about, reimagining urban land use. And they talk early on in the film about what they call the art of growing and food as a revolution. And they are really using these interviews with community organizers and urban growing initiatives and projects across the U.S. To look at how other people are engaging this subject of food as revolution and urban growing, urban agriculture. The film is quite excellent in that it features a variety of perspectives, experiences, models for urban growing, to kind of ask questions about reimagining agriculture in contemporary United States.
Wow, it sounds fascinating. It seems to be like, and it also seems like you made a good choice with Catherine Kelly, because that's what Cultivate KC has really made their mission in doing that here in Kansas City. So I'm glad that she's on the panel.
Yeah, Catherine's awesome, and she's providing some mentorship to us. She has toured the site, the Sunrise Garden Center, with us, and she provides valuable feedback. She's spectacular.
Yeah, that's great. That's great to hear that that people are helping each other and sharing ideas, but sharing what people have learned. Any other plans on the horizon in terms of trying to generate revenue?
Like Rachel mentioned, folks can go to our website at any time, sunriseprojectks.org, and donate. We'll also be having a chef's meal. We have some wonderful chefs that are making a collaborative meal here in Lawrence on May 12th, and that's by invitation. So if you'd like an invitation, be sure to email us, info@sunriseprojectkansas.org. We'll have chefs from Limestone, Pachamama's, charcuterie, all the big dogs here that make wonderful food. We'll have that. And we'll be doing canvassing around the neighborhood, garnering support that way. And we're just going to keep trying everything we can to make this happen.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you guys are putting in a lot of efforts. And it's not just you two, right? I mean, you've got some other folks. I don't want to hear about you guys getting burned out.
We Yes, and we do. We have a strong board, group of board members that have come together.
Advisory committee.
Yes, we have so many excellent people who have agreed to really donate their time and energies in the earliest phases of this Sunrise project.
Absolutely.
All right, Rachel and Melissa, hi, this is Naturally. I wanted to ask you a few questions. Will you tell me a little bit about your Healthy Sprouts project?
Sure, this is Melissa. I helped run the Healthy Sprouts program. It recently went on hiatus when we went through the rest of our grant funding. We worked with 11 child care centers in the community, connecting the youngest people in our community to healthy food through gardens and cooking, and we did a lot of family engagement as well. So we did family field trips to farmers market, local farms. We did cooking classes with families. We did taste tests, and we can't wait to bring the program back. This is the first season in the past 4 years that we haven't been able to help facilitate the gardens at the centers and the other programming, and we're hearing how missed we are. So we're looking forward to getting that going again. We also set up community-supported agriculture at several of our centers, so we really were a benefit to our local farmers as well.
For our listeners that may not be familiar, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with CSAs, but maybe you can briefly explain how those work.
Sure. The way that I explain it is that it's a vegetable subscription service for the most part. You're going to get what is in season, what your farmer is growing. For roughly $15 a week, you'll get a bag delivered. And here we did ours at the child care center to make it really convenient for families. So they come pick their child up from school and they get their bag of veggies.
Oh, that's pretty clever.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it was great. And a couple of our centers, I think, are able to continue that. But Healthy Sprouts really did help facilitate and make those connections between the centers and the farms.
That's great. And do you find that that's a way of getting people who may not have been aware of CSAs, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would say the majority of folks who subscribed were brand new to the concept. So, and really when you're working with child care centers, you're working with a diverse array of families that cuts across all socioeconomic levels. So, we did introduce that concept to a lot of families, and they got a lot of benefit out of that.
Okay, well, I think it's really neat that you have them pick up the food when they pick up their children. I know parents of young children, they just don't have a lot of time. And so I think you're really living up to your mission there, you know, with the intersection of the things that matter, food, health, and community. What was going on where you all live that you wanted to even start a program like this? What needs did you see weren't being fulfilled?
Well, we knew that farm to school and farm to preschool have been growing movements and initiatives across the nation. And, of course, you know, Lawrence, Kansas should be part of that. We saw a need, and that wasn't happening in our community. So my former coworker, Emily Hampton, started the program, and Rich Minder actually wrote the grant for it from Success by Six, so he's in the early childhood development world, and we wanted to bring farm to preschool to Lawrence.
Well, all right. I think I love this picture you have of these three little babies with tomatoes in their hands on your website.
That's a good one.
Yeah, they're adorable. So tell me about this Lawrence Fruit Tree Project.
Sure. The Fruit Tree Project is now in an established community orchard in East Lawrence. They also do take opportunities to educate the community about fruit tree maintenance and hold open work days at the orchard. And anyone in the community can come and participate and learn about perennial fruiting plants, mm-hmm. or come and pick ripe fruits. It's actually quite strategically located along a major throughway, along a major trail that links 23rd Street and beyond, Haskell Indian Nations University, all the way to about 11th Street here in Lawrence. So along that trail, people could come in and see the community orchard and potentially participate or admire the fruit or perhaps even taste some. So that is the Lawrence Fruit Tree Project. And they are truly a very critical part of Sunrise Project's umbrella programming and really understanding of how we envision the center.
So the project that you have that engages the young people of the United Way of Douglas County, is that what is that about?
We are partnering with the United Way this year to organize service projects for youth ages 12 to 18 throughout the summer. And they'll be at a variety of locations and doing a variety of work in our community, including places such as Baker Wetlands, Just Food, our local food bank, Ballard Community Services, Willow Domestic Violence Shelter, and it also offers internships for youth, such as Link, which is one of our free meal opportunities in Lawrence with a community meal every Tuesday, and youth will have the opportunity to be part of that as an internship.
Neat. Well, I love how you have all ages represented in these projects, you know, from the babies up to the adults. Have you found that people that are engaging with these different projects, is it some of their first times gardening or farming?
I found through Healthy Sprouts, for sure. I mean, I would sometimes just set up a table at the child care center and plant a seed with the families, and they take it home, and it sprouted, and they get so excited because they hadn't experienced that before, and families would come back and tell me it inspired them to grow an entire garden. So I do think that this work is important in inspiring that and just making it accessible and fun.
This is like, you know, teach a man to fish.
Yeah. Right, and it's just, and you know, sometimes people try it and they get so much fulfillment out of it that, you know, you do know that their lives have changed.
Did you grow up growing your own food?
I grew a few things. Our family would garden intermittently, but not a real strong tradition, although my grandparents, of course, you know, mm-hmm. they had a dairy farm and grandma baked the bread and, you know, they rarely went to the grocery store. But I am learning how to grow things through trial and error and just kind of like what I teach people when I'm with, you don't have to be an expert. We can just try things out and draw on each other's knowledge and experiences. I grew up in central Illinois in a more rural community and did grow up with family members and parents who really taught us the importance of growing, but also my memories are really influenced by hunting and fishing and learning about medicinal plants and learning about that sort of that cross-generational kind of emphasis that I think we see so is so important to the Sunrise Project Center. That's what I grew up with in terms of my parents and my grandparents, you know, knowledge of local plants and learning about what plants maybe meant to say my dad or my grandmother, and learning about what plants are in the area. Those are a lot of my memories are kind of influenced by that.
That's really special, because I know that not everybody grew up with that, and I didn't grow up with that. I would have loved to have grown up with that, but like it was stated earlier, you know, it's never too late to just jump in, and thankfully there are organizations like you all that's you know, fulfilling that need. It seems like it only took one or two generations for us humans, at least here in America, to get off of the track of, you know, we have fruit-bearing trees in our backyard. We grow tomatoes and vegetables when it's, you know, it's in season, you know. I just find that interesting, don't you?
Absolutely. I'm 39, and I think that most people my age can think back to their grandparents, you know, and that was a generation that was growing their own food. And, you know, if we kind of just reconnect to, you know, traditions and practices that were once part of the way that we lived, that can be very meaningful.
Please.
I see that also as really rooted in, you know, the interconnections that we're trying to make by linking food and environment and social justice, that there are lots of, you know, life experiences that you know, influence people's understandings of having access to safe and affordable and culturally appropriate foods and water supplies and environments in our immediate communities, in our homes, and in our you know, broader communities, that not everyone maybe has that the same experiences or is coming from the same place, all understandings, and we see that as a strength, that we want to make a space that is inclusive of a variety of those understandings, those cultural knowledges, and kind of start from there, engaging a variety of perspectives and possibilities.
Mm-hmm. I think that you really won when, you know, that the word interconnectivity, because it's 2015, you know, I think we're learning by now that, you know, everything is everything. Not one person is mm-hmm. fits in one category. Not one type of issue fits into one category. And we really got to link together just really to get anything done. So when we approach the solution to the different issues that we see in our community, we got to approach them interconnectedly. And I feel like, you know, this is an environmental radio show, and I do the news, and so I got to read all the news, and I read a lot of bad news about, you know, climate change, pollution in the air, pollution in the water, pollution in our earth, and then corporations who seek to continue to, you know, to do things that worsen our environment. But, you know, I think that projects like these really are the answer, because what's going to happen when we get these babies growing the food, you know, we get these families learning this stuff, you know, then what does that mean? What's the bigger picture do you guys see?
Mm. Yes. I mean, all of that, and, you know, imagining Sunrise Project as this educational center, you know, people keep using words, certainly in all of our board meetings and advisory board meetings, that people keep using words like cooperative, like Skillshare, empowering. You know, we want to engage environmental literacies of all kinds, that really we want to be a space that is affirming for both applied skill sets as well as experiential skill sets. So, you know, the example that I like to use is not just how to grow a certain, say, plant or crop or different models for growing a certain plant or crop, but also what that cultural value mm-hmm. to a variety of people that plant may hold. This is because this is at the heart, perhaps, of some of our programming goals. Then that extends into our visions, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Do you see, now when you teach people to garden and to care for the plants and and then get to reap the harvest. Do you see when they learn that new skill set, that does it bleed into other areas of their life, or has it helped shape your life in any other ways, learning these new skills?
Well, I see people benefiting from just being outside and that connection to the environment, you know, through the growing. And, you know, just that one small act of growing a tomato plant for the first time, for example, and seeing your child pick a tomato off, pop it in their mouth, mm-hmm. and want more mm-hmm. inspires them to try even more growing. And then that also leads into, I'm a big proponent of cooking. I taught myself how to cook over the years, and I love sharing that knowledge and seeing people just want to reconnect to their food and their environment and getting a lot of value out of that mm-hmm. And meaning.
And also, there are many of us on the board and advisory committee who are educators in some way, shape, or form, workshoppers, community participants. We see the value of accessible education, educational programming. I'm a professor at the University of Kansas. Melissa has done all sorts of programming and for a variety of different people from a variety of different age groups. And a number of folks who are part of the board have been involved with other workshops, community workshops of programming. So it really is a side of great importance for us that there are these opportunities to share, cooperatively share information cross-generationally, multiculturally, to work towards some of these key points of our center's, you know, vision and values.
I just wanted to remind our listeners that we are speaking about the Sunrise Project. Their website is sunriseprojectks.org. And I really appreciate this organization. I really appreciate the work that you all are doing. And I just feel like food and the planting of that seed is really the beginning of just better life in so many ways, because you said who is a professor at the University of Kansas?
Yes, I'm in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department.
Okay, well, as a teacher, I know you're not teaching young people, but you're teaching people, and we have to eat, and we know that if we don't have good food, we don't have a good meal, it's harder for us to learn.
A lot of my research centers on food and histories of public health and food sovereignty and food justice. And I see those things as really connected to understandings of feminisms and social hierarchy. So I think it's important that we have representatives on our board that range in knowledge sets from the youngest members of our community on up to adults, and the possibility to kind of cross-generationally share information is very important to us.
Well, that sounds great. Before we let you go, a couple things I want to make sure that you've got to let our listeners know about everything you want to let them know, and also just reiterate contact info, website, and tell them again about the event coming up this weekend.
Absolutely. So we want everyone to come join us this Sunday, the 19th, from 4 to 7 at Liberty Hall here in Lawrence, which is located at 644 Massachusetts Street, downtown. Beautiful location. We're going to have our screening of the Growing Cities documentary, which is all about urban farming across the United States. And dinner will be provided, donated from 23rd Street Brewery, and we have an awesome panel of speakers, Catherine Kelly, Dina Newman, Richard Mavian, Brett Rainey, moderated by Magali Rabassa. So join us. You can purchase tickets on our website, or you can buy tickets at the door. And for more information, you can find us at sunriseprojectks.org. We're on Facebook, Sunrise Project Kansas, Instagram, and
Thank you. Did you have something else?
Naturally? Oh, no, that's all. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It sounds like you're so busy, and so we really appreciate you taking time out of all that to talk about it for a little bit.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
Okay, sure. Yeah, well, good luck, and do keep in touch with us, because keep us posted with what's going on, because we'd like to have you back again.
Thank you.
All right. You guys have a nice evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to go to some messages, and we'll hear from Climate Connections, and then we'll be back.
This week, the moral challenges of the Aid in Dying movement.
I don't think anywhere in the Judeo-Christian tradition will you find any permission or justification for taking one's own life.
The question is, should that view be imposed upon someone who doesn't subscribe to it?
I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked.
Tune in to Radioactive Magazine Tuesday at 6 p.m. to hear more from Jonathan Edwards, the American theologian from the 18th century, as Greg Schwartz and Bill Claus, two freethinkers, talk about killing for God. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday, 6 p.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Point Reyes Seashore National Park has over 80 miles of coastline. North of San Francisco, the park attracts more than 2 million visitors every year. But rising seas and more extreme storm surge endanger the coastline and the northern elephant and harbor seal pups born in the park. To raise awareness about climate change impacts, the park is hosting a traveling art quilt exhibit. Each piece uses fabric to illustrate an impact of global warming. For example, one quilt depicts rooftops barely visible behind a wall of seawater.
If you come into our main visitor center and you see this very attractive art display, you're going to walk up to it to say, "What is this?" And as you start to read the captions that go with these quilts, you're going to be educated even more on how can we make a difference as our planet is changing.
That's John DeLasso, Chief of Interpretation and Resource Education for the park.
This is just another way to increase the public's awareness of an issue such as this and hopefully give them hope. Here's what you personally can do about maybe lessening this and slowing it down.
Together, the diverse quilts piece together climate impacts and solutions. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hi, Kansas City. This is Naturally, and I have your environmental events for the week. Earth Advocacy, what difference can you make? Now, this event does start in 10 minutes, so if you are by the Village Presbyterian Church on Mission Road, swing on in. It lasts till 9 p.m., and perhaps some of you are already on your way. Sustainable Sanctuary Coalition's monthly program will feature the topic Earth Advocacy, what difference can you make? At the program, attendees can learn about how the relationship between daily actions and large environmental issues. Mary Lindsay, who has volunteered with groups such as the Sierra Club and Move to Amend, will present on how each of us can work to do advocacy in our communities and beyond. This event is from 7 to 9 p.m. this evening at Village Church at 6641 Mission Road in Prairie Village, Kansas. Pollinators, Feel the Love. This event is on April 16th at 6:30 p.m. The Master Gardeners of Greater Kansas City present this event with Betsy Betros, author and active citizen scientist. Betros will talk about the birds and the bees and a thing called love. Learn about the world of pollinators and why and how your garden can become a safe home for the most important group of pollinators. This free event will be held Thursday, April 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Kauffman Foundation Conference Center, which is located at 4801 Rock Hill Road in Kansas City, Missouri. No registration is required, and for more information, you can visit mggkc.org. And finally, the event put on by the two members of the Sunrise Project, we interviewed on today's show, Growing Cities, fundraiser for the Sunrise Project. It takes place on Sunday, April 19th from 4 to 7 p.m. in Lawrence, Kansas. Tickets include dinner and a panel of dynamic speakers on food and environmental justice. Please find out more about this fundraiser and this group at sunriseprojectks.org.
Well, thank you very much for all that pertinent information, naturally, and thanks to Melissa and Rachel for joining us tonight and for all the work they're doing there in Lawrence. We do have This Week in Water back, so we'll play that. We've got a couple more messages, one about Wes Jackson from the Land Institute in Kansas, will be on alternative radio on Wednesday morning, so we'll hear all about that. But first, this message.
The Missouri Legislative Black Caucus and the Jackson County Bar Association present Law 101, free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys. The next class, Civil Law versus Criminal Law, is April 14th from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Mary L. Kelly Center, located at 2803 East 51st Street, Kansas City, Missouri. For more information, please call 816-651-0044. This is a public service announcement of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
The Land Institute's Wes Jackson.
No more feudal system, no more plantations, no more Soviet-style state capitalism, no more industrial agriculture of the 19th, 20th, and early 21st centuries.
On the next Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
The human polar bear? That and other stories for the week ending April 12th, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Can the California water crisis get any worse? The outlook as the state enters its fourth year of drought is bleak, and in response, Governor Jerry Brown announced statewide water cutbacks of 25% and even 35% in a few areas.
But agriculture was left untouched by the mandate, and that had many crying foul. They claim the governor gave in to the powerful ag industry, which uses about 80% of the state's water. Others point out, however, that farmers have already endured big cuts in the water they receive from the federal government and from the state water project.
In San Diego, water officials are pushing back against Brown's order, insisting that across-the-board cuts could undermine the local economy, and that the reduction order was based on average consumption in 2013, a time by which significant conservation had already been achieved.
San Diego also claims they've been working to find alternative sources of water. They point to the county's $1 billion investment in desalination that, once online, could provide 50 million gallons of fresh water per day, about 8% of the county's total consumption.
Recently, H2O Radio was in Southern California talking to residents about the water crisis. Most were well aware of the situation, pointing out that warnings are all over television and even on freeway billboards.
All the people we spoke to were on board with doing their share, but some were frustrated at the state's slow response.
I wish they'd been more proactive years ago, and it just is a little bit annoying that they let it get to the point where it's a crisis before we do anything to fix it. This is nothing new to California, you know, and I'd rather have a desalinization plant than a train to Modesto, so.
While this woman and those in San Diego might see the vast Pacific as a source of fresh water and an easy fix for their woes, they should know that there are serious downsides. Taking the salt out of seawater uses a huge amount of electricity, which in turn increases carbon dioxide emissions, leading to global warming.
Many also point out that the effects of the briny discharge from desalination plants can have a significant impact on marine life.
One Russian company thinks it has the answer to two of those problems by going nuclear.
Last month, the company announced it was planning to sell nuclear-powered desalination technology to foreign countries. The hope is that the generated power will be cost-efficient and won't produce as much carbon as fossil fuels.
The Russian company is already cooperating with Iranian officials to build small nuclear plants and desalination facilities in the south of Iran. It seems that the drought in many parts of the world is now being used to justify using nuclear power to supply us with clean drinking water.
In response to all this nuclear power talk tied to desalination, one word that might come to mind, Fukushima. few weeks ago, we told you about an Indian man who recently won what had been dubbed the Nobel Prize for Water for his idea to revive traditional reservoirs called jhats to get water to more than 1,000 villages in India.
That man is not the only one turning to ancient technologies for modern water woes. New Scientist is reporting that in Lima, Peru, the city's water utility is planning to revive a system of ancient stone canals and pools known as amunas that were built by the Wari culture who lived in the Andes centuries before the Incas.
The amunas concept is simple. Keep water from flowing directly downhill and instead funnel it along mountainsides to allow it to slowly percolate into rocks that feed springs at lower elevations. Weeks or even months later, when the dry season kicks in, the water is available to quench the thirst of Lima, one of the world's largest desert cities.
Although the project is awaiting funding from Peru's National Water Regulator, the NGOs backing the plan estimate that restoring amunas could reduce the city's current water deficit in the dry season by as much as 60%. And at a price tag of $23 million, it would be a drop in the bucket when compared to water delivered from a desalination plant, and a whole lot greener, too.
There's a man you should know about whom many call the human polar bear.
He's endurance swimmer Lewis Pugh, and dressed in nothing but a Speedo, has just completed the fifth in a series of epic swims in some of the coldest waters on Earth.
Why? To draw attention to the Ross Sea, a bay of the Southern Ocean in Antarctica, 2,000 miles below New Zealand, that is threatened by overfishing and climate change. He hopes his feat will break the political deadlock that has prevented the huge expanse of sea, bigger than the UK, Germany, and France combined, from being designated as a marine protected area.
For more than 4 years, the parties to the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources have tried and failed to establish sanctuaries in the Ross Sea. Hopes were high, but Russia's annexation of the Crimea and the downing of the Malaysian Airlines flight over Ukraine reignited Cold War tensions.
How to thaw the Cold War? If you're Lewis Pugh, you dive in for some Speedo diplomacy, and it might be working. According to The Guardian, he's captured the imagination of the Russian people and its politicians, appearing on Russian television and newspaper covers.
Pugh, who, as a maritime lawyer in London, worked on the litigation of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska, said that protecting oceans is the single biggest issue facing the world, and he should know. He has done long-distance swims in all of them, the last one enduring an average water temperature of 30 degrees.
And finally this week, goldfish. No, not the cute cheddar snacks, the real kind that you'd find in a fishbowl.
Well, that's where you should find them, but last month, Colorado Parks and Wildlife discovered a booming goldfish population in a lake in Boulder, Colorado. Officials believe a handful were discarded into the lake about 2 years ago, where they started to multiply.
Now there are thousands, and not the cute little 2-inch numbers. Outside the confines of a bowl and unchecked by predators, the fish have grown to several inches long and now threaten local species by taking up resources in the lake and potentially bringing diseases to native fish.
What to do about this problem? There are three plans under consideration, from electrocuting the fish with electric prods to giving them a plant-based chemical that would kill the fish but leave mammals, birds, and reptiles unaffected. They could also just drain the lake.
So if you do have fish at home you no longer want, harming public waters with little Nemos is not the answer. You can try to return your fish to a pet store or, as one marine biologist suggested, give the little critters a more humane send-off, say with a martini.
Here's how. Put the fish in a bucket of water, anesthetize them with clove oil, and then put vodka in the bucket. Don't shake or stir and let the alcohol ease the transition to the hereafter. Somewhere.
This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
California's drought takes a toll on migrating birds. On this current cast.
Each winter, the skies over California's Central Valley fill with birds.
Northern pintail, mallards, gadwall, Pacific whitefront geese, Ross's geese, snow geese, also sandhill cranes and tundra swans.
That's Dan Frisk of the Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge. He says the migrating birds winter over in the area's seasonally flooded wetlands and post-harvest rice fields. But this year's drought means much of the habitat is dry, and the birds are at risk for disease and predation as they crowd into smaller areas. The situation could become even more dire if the drought extends into future years. So Frisk says it's important to monitor the birds and learn from the experience. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.